This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, which one would you choose? You probably go to the wall, do everything you can to stay in power so you can prevent the long hand of the law from grabbing you and putting you where you should be.
In a little over 10 weeks, every American citizen will have the opportunity to have their vote counted to either elect a new president or to keep the current president in place. Or that's what's supposed to happen in theory, anyway. In reality, the principle of one person, one vote is violated in American electoral practices. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to political writer John Storr of the editorial board about the upcoming American presidential election and about the gross inequities built into the Electoral College system. We also discuss whether the goal of unifying the country should take a backseat to advancing truth, justice, and equity. And we contemplate what Donald Trump's endgame is for this election. Is he truly driven by a desire to lead the country for four more years? Or is he mostly just thinking being president is the best way to stay out of prison? I'm joined now again on Sea Change Radio by John Storr. He is the founder of the editorial board, and he is a visiting assistant professor of public policy at Wesleyan University. John, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me again, Alex.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you, and I've been dreading having this conversation for a little bit because I really wanted to talk about the election with you, and I try to view things through as much of a rose-colored lens as possible because the downside of it is just so scary for so many of us. But your opinion pieces on the editorial board are clear-eyed and sobering and often so informative. So why don't we first start with the Electoral College? You wrote a piece recently called The Electoral College as Incentive to Kill. So when somebody would think about the validity of the Electoral College, they usually wouldn't think of something like a deadly global pandemic being tied into it. But in this case, it is.
Yeah, you know, a lot of liberal lefty types like we are, we're right away will say, it's Trump's fault that we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's Trump's fault that the economy is on the brink of collapse. Everything's Trump's fault. But you got to think about also, in my view, the structural incentives for an income poop like our president to make the decisions that he made. And thanks to an expose in Vanity Fair that was published, I think it was last month, we know that part of his decision-making as to how to respond to the pandemic in the early months of the pandemic, we know from this expose that politics was clearly on his mind. And at first, the White House had a national approach. It was going to the federal government was going to be a clearinghouse for resources and money that each of the states needed to take care of the pandemic as it arose in each of those states and municipalities. But then, because the president really thought he was going to be running for re-election on the economy, he started to minimize and back away from the pandemic, such that he was throwing the responsibility for it to the states, right? And so this is all in the expose. The team led by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, decided that they were going to back away from a national approach and just take a quote-unquote states' rights approach, which is just basically fling responsibility for all this onto the states. The reason they came to that decision was partly because of the president's approach on running for re-election on the economy, but also because at the time, believe it or not, they thought, this is a blue state thing. Those people are going to be affected the most. It's going to run its course. They really thought it was just going to go away. Now, why do we even talk about red and blue states? That's the question. And the reason we talk about red and blue states is because of the Electoral College. We individuals, and I want your listeners to really understand this, individual Americans do not vote for president. States vote for presidents. And the reason that states vote for president is because of the Electoral College. If individuals determine the outcome of a presidential election, then the popular vote would be the conclusion, right? Whoever won the popular vote. But we, as we all know, the popular vote means nothing. The Electoral College vote is what matters. So this is because states vote for president, and because we have a president who literally, I think, looks at a map and says, oh, Montana, no Democrats there. Oh, New York, no Republicans there. He literally thinks that. He thought, well, just let's let this pandemic go. And this is why I came to the conclusion that the Electoral College is an incentive to murder.
And is there any solution to it that's realistic?
Yes.
It would probably involve, I imagine, step one, doing away with the filibuster in the Senate, right?
Yeah, this is another part of the conversation, a related part of the conversation, and that is that no matter what happens, let's presume that Joe Biden wins in a landslide.
Right. And then we'll consider this a huge mandate, and Democrats have a majority in the Senate, but definitely not filibuster-proof.
Right. Let's just presume that happens. But a lot of people right now are thinking that the GOP is on a ventilator. The GOP is infected, and it is going to die. It's just a matter of time. It's not if, it's when. Even if Joe Biden wins in a landslide, that is not going to be the end of the GOP. It is also not going to be the end of creeping authoritarianism either. And that is because our system favors the Republicans. A, the Electoral College. B, the Senate. C, the filibuster.
John, we were talking about the Electoral College and whether or not it's a unifying or divisive concept. But maybe we should take a step back and discuss whether or not we're ready to be unified as a country. We always just assume that unity is a good thing, and that's been a bedrock of our system of government. But when we saw President Obama strive for unity, I think that's where the left found holes in his policies, that he was reaching out to bad actors. I guess the larger point I'm making is maybe we're not ready for unity. Maybe we need competent government for a generation and an education system that will start to eviscerate the ignorance that we see when it comes to basic truths of policy and government.
Yeah, I mean, people don't know what they need until they need it, and the pandemic is reshaping some of that. Thought process. I saw a poll the other day that said, you know, would you rather the government stay out of your life or would you rather the government lend a hand? And it was a pretty big majority, something in the 60s, saying we need a hand. And then I read also this morning that this week is the 22nd week in a row that 1 million people per week have filed for unemployment insurance. That dwarfs, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that dwarfs what the equivalent was in the Great Recession. I don't remember numbers being that high for that long. The only reason that we're not feeling the pain that we felt back then is because of fiscal stimulus. You know, $2.5 trillion shoved into the economy has floated people along so far, and the spigot was cut off at the end of July, and the president so far thinks that he has the upper hand in, I have no idea really what he's thinking, I'm not sure anybody else does, but he apparently believes that he has the advantage because he can just sign an executive order and suddenly the money will start flowing, when in fact that's not the case at all.
Or he can just make up some new cherry-picked stats like Mike Pence said a couple weeks ago, saying we've created more jobs in the last 3 months than Joe Biden and Barack Obama created in their 8 years in office.
Well, that's another problem is with a lack of unity, is that there's so much falsehood out there, and it's coming from the top, but there's also so much desire to believe falsehood. That's what a lot of people miss in punditry. You know, plenty of people say, you know, the president's lying and he shouldn't be lying and we should, democracy can't be built on lies, etc. But we also have a republic who with about 40% of its residents, some of its citizens, wanting to believe lies because lies are better. You know, they like that better. This is called bad faith. It's a willingness, a desire to believe falsehoods because the truth is too much. It's too overwhelming for whatever reason. And I don't know if there's really any solution to lying. We like to believe the truth will win out, right? But the truth is so much harder, first of all, to establish. It's so much harder to communicate because it's probably more nuanced. It's probably complex. People have short attention spans. They're distracted. Lies are so easy. And we have a president who, like, every third word is a lie. And the people he's communicating with, like I said, it's about 40% of the population. They like the lies.
Lock her up. It's one of their hits.
This is a great example of, so Lock Her Up is about Benghazi, about the terrorist attacks in Benghazi, where four Americans died, right? And it was on September 11th, 2012, believe it or not, it was September 11th. September 11th, 2012, four Americans died. And the Republican Party, especially in the House, and Fox News, and the rest of the right-wing media universe, would believe that one death was too many and that Hillary Clinton was surely guilty of some crime and that the Obama administration was denying justice in failing to prosecute her or some nonsense. I'm giving voice to that point of view. Well, as of today, I think 180,000 Americans are dead from the coronavirus pandemic. And as of, I think it was over the weekend, a CBS poll came out saying that 57% of Republicans thought that a death toll like that was acceptable, right? Like that the government didn't need to do more than it's already doing, right? So, okay, four Americans die in one, you know, let's think of a split screen. Four Americans on the left, 180,000 Americans on the right. Right, 180,000 is 45,000 times the number of dead people in Benghazi. You know, and that seems to be okay. Now, why? It's because there's lots of people in this country who believe they want to believe falsehoods. They don't want to believe the truth, and that's the problem. A democracy is always going to have this problem, and I don't know of anybody who's really come up with a solution to it except to have an overwhelming majority exert its power, which I hope will happen in November.
When the days has passed and gone, and that road you traveled on just don't seem to be going anywhere.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to John Storr of the editorial board. So looking at things like the Electoral College and election night, November 3rd, you wrote a piece called Election Night Will End in 2021. And I want to dive into that, but you were just talking about we have to play on the same, things have to be kind of on an even playing field. You make the parallel with sports and politics, and you say, let me just quote you, there's nothing wrong with treating American politics like a sport as long as everyone involved in the competition is playing the same sport by the same rules.
There's going to be lots of doom and gloom in this conversation, but let me start with a ray of hope.
Hey, that's why we pay you the big bucks.
Let me start with a ray of hope, and that was came from Hillary Clinton this week, ironically, perhaps. She said in an interview someplace, I don't remember where, but she said that Joe Biden should not concede an inch, never concede, is basically what she said.
Yes, I read that, and I love that.
Yeah, and that's exactly – now, the reason why I think that's hopeful is, A, because Democrats have conceded in the past, Al Gore.
Well, Al Gore did, but he took a fight, and then, but most notably to me, it was John Kerry, because I thought that that was an election, and things were just very funky in Ohio, to say the least, and we shouldn't have just
let it go.
But we went by the same thing, like, oh, I don't want to put the nation through the same thing that we had to go through in 2000. Well, there's, and that was a mistake.
Well, right. So we've gone through 2000, 2004, and Hillary Clinton, and I hope the Joe Biden campaign understand. We can't do that again, right? So on the one hand, it's like, whew, you know, if somebody like Hillary Clinton is saying don't concede, that probably means that the Biden campaign will not concede, right?
And she probably regrets conceding.
Perhaps. It's hard to say. But that is really important because you don't want you want the Democrats to be firm. You don't want them to be squishes, right? So, but on the other hand, too, that says – Since she is saying don't concede, it gives you an idea like the Biden campaign knows what Trump is capable of doing and willing to do, right? They're not going into this thinking, hey, it's a fair game, you know, to the best man, may the best man win. No, you know, this is not that, and nor should you have that attitude because you will get crushed.
And Trump is approaching this like a blood sport. And the Republicans have shown that for the last two decades, and Democrats need to approach it similarly, unfortunately.
Right. And so Clinton's statement really is saying that the Democrats have really figured this out. Like, they're just, this is politics, right? And you need to treat it like politics, like a blood sport. Now, you try to, like, do it for noble reasons. You know, I wouldn't say that the Republicans are noble, but... Anyway, that's where you should begin, is that probably they're not going to concede at all. But what's likely to happen, and I think the Biden campaign sees this, is that Trump is already saying the election is rigged, that it's going to be fraudulent, that the only way he's going to lose is if there's cheating, right? And of course, what's going to happen probably is that there will be a massive number of votes that are tabulated over the course of a week or so because of absentee balloting due to the coronavirus pandemic. And as time goes by, Biden's tally will go up and up and up. And each day that goes by, Trump will say, ha, this is evidence that I was right. I'm being robbed, and so are my people, right? And so he's going to use this as rationale to, you know, send his lawyers to every swing state and every county to delay the vote, possibly even declare this is the really scary part, possibly even declare a national emergency and therefore triggering what are called presidential emergency action documents that nobody really knows about because they're secret. All he has to do really is the president only has to say, I think China attacked our elections and pull the lever for a national emergency. What will happen is that the Department of Justice will be deployed to swing states to do quote-unquote investigations, right? And that at this point, then, it's about running down the clock toward December 14th, I think, which was the day that the Supreme Court said the 2000 election had to be decided. And so they're winding down the clock all the way to December 14th. At some point, the election will be either thrown to the Supreme Court or will be thrown to the House of Representatives. The Supreme Court, nobody knows what will happen. Maybe John Roberts will think, I got to take one for the country. I don't know. If it goes to the House of Representatives, it's actually questionable what might happen there. This process that I'm talking about would not be just a simple majority. It would be about the number of delegates that are determined by who controls which side of each state's Congress. I know I'm getting into the weeds here, but the point is that the Biden would not be safe in the House of Representatives. In fact, the president has the advantage. So that's really scary, right?
Terrifying.
That's terrifying.
It also brings me to another piece that you wrote. What is this president's bigger motive? Why does he want to be president? He obviously doesn't like governing. He doesn't like working. He doesn't care about anybody but himself and maybe those closest to him. But you say, is staying out of jail Trump's real motive? I think there's a lot to that. Why don't you explain the thesis?
Yeah. Well, first to begin with, the whole people say he just likes the attention and likes being in power. I mean, that's probably true, but I don't think that's incentive enough. And maybe, you know, his corruption and money grubbing is enough to want to stay in power. That's true too. But I think fear of being caught is probably a bigger incentive for him. I mean, this is a guy who has been skimming the public till for the past 4 years. He's been built. Oh my God, so much corruption and bilking of Republican donors.
There's a lot of dirt.
Yeah, let's put it this way. Steve Bannon, the former advisor, was just arrested recently for bilking Republican donors.
And add him to the never-ending list of people close to Trump who are convicted felons or alleged felons.
Right. And, you know, Bannon's just small beer compared to the big boss. You know, so the big boss is really skimming people. So, I mean, that plus whatever's in his tax returns, whatever his business has been doing. Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer, who has been convicted and incarcerated, said that he inflates the value of his property to get more in lending, and then he deflates the value of his property to pay less in taxes. Now the New York State's Attorney General is going through an investigation to figure out all, you know, what's up and what's down. At some point, if he's not dead from his bad diet and other things, you know, at some point you got to think fate will catch up with him. Now the question will be not if but when he gets caught, and then also if he's still president, right? If he's not president anymore and gets caught, he's not going to have any power other than lawyers to defend himself. But if he's president and gets caught, well, he's got the whole United States government on his side. You know, which one would you choose? You know, you probably go to the wall, do everything you can to stay in power so you can prevent the long hand of the law from grabbing you and putting you where you should be.
I guess it's going to be interesting to see how far Joe Biden is willing to learn from his predecessors. When you hear a Hillary Clinton saying, do not concede, I also hope that Barack Obama has some regrets about reaching across the aisle, because I think that set back those 8 years in a lot of ways, because no matter what he did, they called him a socialist and questioned his Americanness or whatever it was. They were not going to work with him. And so right now you have these bad actors and you have a criminal in the White House. Maybe you're worried about it coming back to your own party. Well, there's a reason why we have laws. If the Democratic Party is breaking laws and you have Democrats breaking laws, a president, they should not be above the law. And that was one of the first things that people of my generation learned from Nixon and Watergate. And then I remember being an 8-year-old and
asking my parents, why isn't he going to jail? I was like, oh, well, the president pardoned him. Well, wasn't the president his vice president? Yeah. So that to me was a fundamental head scratcher for my 8-year-old brain. And we've gone through much worse in the last 4 years. And I hope we can kind of stem that tide of the system breaking down, because that's really what this is at this point.
And maybe this is my closing comment. Another bright silver lining from Hillary Clinton's comment about not conceding is that maybe the Democrats will set aside their reluctance to prosecute the previous president. Right now, there's still talk, and Biden's still talking this way about, you know, we have to move on as a country. A democracy can't be prosecuting and convicting its previous presidents. That will be a precedent that goes too far. I think exactly the opposite. The seed has already been planted. The Senate Intelligence Committee released its big, massive report last week that your listeners probably know about. And one of the things they did in this report is reveal that they had referred Bannon and a few other associates to the FBI for criminal investigation, meaning lying to the Congress. And one of those people was Donald Jr., right?
Oh, please let him go to jail.
The point here is that the Senate Intelligence Committee referred to the FBI a criminal investigation, right? Well, it's just been sitting there, you know, because William Barr, the Attorney General, is just letting it sit there. Well, whoever's the next Attorney General doesn't have to let it just sit there, right? The next Attorney General can assign a prosecutor and say, see this thing through. The bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee made this referral, so there you go. That's our cover, right? You know, now both the Republicans and the Democrats said we should do this. Now let's see this process through. And so I think there should be like vast investigations, but if it's just that one thing, I think that's a reason to hope for the future, so that the American people can have more faith in their government. Biden doesn't seem to understand that you can't, you know, have to move on as a country is not going to instill trust. And that's what's most – trust is – beneath the lies and the bad faith and the propaganda is the problem of trust. You know, we can't, as a country, trust our federal government enough to do the right thing. You know, this pandemic is a proof positive that you can't trust the federal government to do the right thing. But so if you prosecute bad actors and see justice served, then that's laying the groundwork for people to have trust.
Well, I trust that you will keep giving us insight that is valuable and always thought-provoking, and I hope we can talk right after the election again, and we're in a much less dark place in many ways. John Storr, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fog Swamp and Albert King. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.